John, you're going to have to help me with that pronunciation, please. Merceau?
You had it right, almost.
Did I?
It's Mercier.
Oh, I did.
Yeah,
okay.
It's Mercier Eliade.
Is that French?
No, it's Romanian.
Oh, Romanian. Okay. All right,
yeah.
Great. Well, John, thank you so much. Thank you so much for being on the show here tonight, especially for calling at 3 o'clock in the morning. So I promise I'll try to keep you awake.
Well, I'm a creature. I'm pretty much an nocturnal creature, so I don't mind being up at this hour. And it's a great pleasure to be with you. And I want to thank you for providing me the opportunity to speak to those whose mind and hearts are being attracted by the power of the goddess, because in fact I don't give interviews anymore because people haven't been asking me to talk about the divine feminine. And since you asked, here I am.
Well, I wonder why that is. Do you have, we feel like here, maybe it's just a little bubble I'm living in, you know, we're feeling like there's a resurgence. And if it's not necessarily about goddess's deity, it's certainly about goddess as in her ideals. But why do you think that might be? Why do you think, at least from within your circles, is it just there in Europe that interest in goddess has tapered off?
No, I don't think so. I think that, generally speaking, there is a wave of attraction toward the goddess, and I definitely feel that she might usually call the divine Sophia, an aggressor by many names, is calling to the human species in a remarkable way right now. And I believe that a resurgence of goddess wisdom and magic and beauty is imminent. At the same time, there is a lot of distraction. And I would say that the resurgence, the wave of resurgence, is less discussed than it could be, simply because it hasn't been given the right definition that is going to lock it into people's minds, you see? So it has to be brought into the right definition. The frequency has to be tuned exactly right so that people will know. When they hear and feel the power of the goddess reach them, they'll know what is reaching them. And right now they're feeling it and hearing it, but they're not exactly, they're vague about what it is.
Okay.
Does that make any sense?
No, it does. It does. And I do have to admit I'm having a little bit trouble hearing you. When we spoke before the show, you were very clear. Have you made any adjustments since you first got on the phone with me?
No, I can turn up the volume a little bit. This is better.
Yes, that is better, because I was struggling a little bit, but okay.
Okay, sorry about that.
No, that's fine.
I think there's a tremendous resurgence in through our whole species, but what has to happen, I feel, there has to be a critical moment. We're in that moment now, as we speak, when the goddess, in a particular way, comes to definition in our imaginations and hearts in a way that she has not yet so far. That's what I hear.
Well, I've thought this myself, you know, for probably the last, I don't know, 6 or 8 months, you know, maybe this is what it's like to live in a paradigm shift. I sort of think maybe we are at the beginning of the paradigm shift, and if you feel differently, feel free to say so. But to live in a shift every day, it's not like we're just going to wake up one day and things, there's going to be a profound change. You know, it feels like it's these tiny little two steps forward, one step back, kind of a thing, or even one step forward, two steps back. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I can only give you my personal response. That's not the way I experience the shift. No, I don't experience the shift as incremental at all. I experience it as spectacular and sudden every single day.
Well, elaborate on that a little bit. I mean, you know, maybe I need to be hit between the eyes, you know, a little bit harder with a clue by four. Maybe I'm missing some of the signs. So tell me what you're seeing. Believe me, I want to hear what I'm missing.
Well, I don't want to sound presumptuous, but if I could proceed in that vein, it's not a matter of being, certainly not a matter of being hit by a 2x4. It's more a matter of the having your sense of connection becoming so acute that it overwhelms and permeates everything in your life.
Well, no, I'm not really talking on a personal level. You know, I'm talking about as a, you know, as a, you know, across the globe kind of phenomena, I guess.
There is no global phenomena without an intimate personal awakening in each person.
Well, and I understand that, you know, and those of us that know
her.
Yeah. I mean, we have that personal connection. But I'm thinking about that paradigm shift we all talk about, you know, that 100th monkey, you know, when she is really, you know, in the psyche of more people, she's more restored to the center of our cultures, you know, if not maybe, you know, in everybody's mind as a feminine face of God, at least the world is more enlightened, uplifted, you know, living more in harmony and balance. But it seems like, you know, these factors are more at odds than ever before. I mean, at least it does here in the United States, you know. I'm just curious your take. I mean, you're on the other side of the globe. It may feel totally different to you.
Well, no, I recognize what you're talking about, Karen. And I think in a sense we're sort of talking at different angles to each other here. What you say, in my mind, would apply very accurately to the phenomenon of struggle, the phenomenon of adjustment that is happening across society. And in that phenomenon, people are fluctuating by increments, as you say, and they're struggling with these this paradigm shift. So I would completely agree with that analysis. What I'm saying is that that's not my experience. My experience is of a sudden, spectacular, everyday involvement in a new reality with her.
But you're talking about your relationship with her on a personal level, not a global recognition of her.
I don't think very much, frankly, about the global recognition. All I think about is my connection with her. That may sound really selfish, but I'm being brutally honest with you.
No, and that's fine. You know, I get that. I guess, you know, so many of us, you know, have just, you know, we love our connection with her, of course. I mean, it makes our life worth living. I mean, she's been the passion behind everything I've done for the last 25 years. But, you know, we want that to, you know, translate into a changed world, too, you know, and that seems to be the struggle. You know, we're starting to, people, you know, there seems to be so much becoming so much more transparent. You know, the evildoers, it seems like, are being much more quickly exposed. So I don't know. That wasn't what we were supposed to talk about, though.
No, I would agree with you that the evil, what I call the orchestration of evil by certain demented human beings, some of whom are murderous psychopaths, it has to be said, is becoming so painfully obvious that any intelligent person can hardly avoid it. I guess this is a really interesting place to dance to start our conversation, because it raises a question about how we would participate in the global awakening to Sophia, or to the goddess, contrasted to how we would experience it in an intimate and personal way apart from that global awakening. You see? Now, perhaps for you, there is no difference. Your own experience of the goddess and your dedication all these years has been intimately connected with your desire to see a global recognition and a global awakening. Would that be true?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good summation. You know, I've wanted to expand out. So, you know, this world that's so oppresses so many, that's so out of balance, you know, we start to get it right instead of, you know, being parasites on the earth, you know.
Well, perhaps this point of our discussion would be a place where I could explain a little to the listeners about how I came to discover what I consider to be the catalytic factor in awakening to the divine feminine. Would that be a place we could go?
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
Because this was a momentous discovery for me. It comes out of my career as a comparative mythologist. And it answers the issue we were discussing in a way, because I'm convinced that this single catalytic element is not only what brings a person into intimate connection with the goddess, the most intimate connection, but also what would engender the kind of collective and planetary social awakening that you are dedicated to. It is the basis of both of those. Are you there?
Oh, yeah, I was waiting for your next statement. I'm sorry. I thought you were about to segue into something else.
I just want to make sure that, yeah?
No, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that I framed this correctly before I make my statement.
Okay.
Okay.
I think I'm still maybe having a little bit problem hearing you, so I apologize. Is there any way you can click up your volume just a tad more?
How's this? Is this better?
It is. You sound clear. If you were maybe speaking more directly into the phone too.
I'm not speaking in the phone. I'm speaking into my computer.
Ah, okay. Okay. Well,
I'm leaning over it now. Better?
Okay, that's much better. I think if maybe before you were a little bit farther away, it was making your voice just a little bit muffled. So I apologize.
Okay.
I don't think I grasped everything you said. So I hate
what I'm saying is I discovered in my work as a comparative mythologist, and I'll talk about that in a moment, that there is a single catalytic element which brings the goddess alive in a person's life, and that's also probably the element that will engender the greatest social and collective recognition of the goddess. And I'd like to say what that is.
And please go ahead. I assume it's Sophia.
That's right. You know, comparative mythology is a pretty rare vocation, Karen. There are very few comparative mythologists in the world because most mythologists specialize in one tiny area. But a comparative mythologist like Joseph Campbell or Mircea Eliade will look at all the myths of the world, Polynesia, China, Tibet, Russia, Greek, the Greek and Latin myths, Mesopotamian, South American, everything.
Now, you see, that surprises me. That really does surprise me, and really I didn't know that, because as a goddess, independent goddess scholar, you know, part of what we do is not focus on one tradition. You know, we look at all the many traditions. So that's enlightening to know that they really do sort of narrow in on just one mythology rather than looking at many mythologies across the board.
Yeah, well, insofar as they've been men, like Joseph Campbell, these mythologists have been men. They specialize, but a few of these men have been comparative. Now, when you look at the women who were responsible for the goddess revival, like Merlin Stone and Diane Bolstein, Maria Gimbutas, people like that, those women took a comparative viewpoint when they went back to discover and recover the goddess lore. But that has not been the general rule in mythology.
Ah, okay.
So I had the good fortune to take the path of comparative mythology. And as I was studying this, self-educated person, throughout my life, I looked over thousands of myths, and many of them were myths about the goddess. They could be found in Chinese mythology or in Navajo folklore or whatever you want. As you know, they're found everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But then
I came upon these Nag Hammadi materials, which are said to be fragments that have survived of Gnostic writings that were largely destroyed with the rise of Christianity. And I describe that scenario in my book, Not in His Image, starting with the murder of Hypatia, or Hypatia, you know who that is.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure your listeners know. So the murder of Hypatia in 415 AD pretty much announced the destruction of the goddess wisdom of the pagan world in Europe and the rise of Christianity and what I call paternal religion, that is the religion of the father god and the male domination of religion. So what I found in these Gnostic texts were the fragments of a pagan goddess myth that had pre-existed Christianity and that probably has had existed for thousands of years. And when I began to reconstruct this myth and piece it together from the Gnostic writings, I began to be really astonished because I realized that of all the myths of the goddess that I had studied, this one was different. This one, the myth of the fallen Sophia, the goddess who falls from the galactic center, could not be compared to any other myth of the goddess. Although there were many similarities with other myths, it seemed to have a unique and coherent structure as I reconstructed it.
So what does it mean when you say she falls from the galactic center?
Well, this myth is a true planetary myth. The myth of the Gnostic Sophia describes a divine power in the galactic center, which is called the Pleroma. And by galactic center, I don't mean something vague. I mean something very specific. That is the core or hub of our galaxy. As you know, the solar system is located in a spiral galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
And there are 2 billion stars in this galaxy. The sun is one of those stars. And at the center, it's like a pinwheel galaxy. And at the center of this galaxy is a core or hub of absolutely pure, divine, cosmic life force and light. And according to the Gnostic myth of the Sophia, which was taught by the Gnostics in the mystery schools, one of the divinities, they call them aeons, A-E-O-N, that's the Gnostic Greek word for a god. One of the divinities in the cosmic center actually did something that the divinities usually don't do. The way that they usually operate, so we are told in this myth, is that they project by their imaginations and by the power of their divine love and animation, they project experiments into the galactic limbs. They project plans and ideas which materialize in the galactic limbs in the form of different worlds. So the Gnostics actually taught a many-world cosmology. They affirmed that our solar system, our galaxy, this single galaxy, it's a story about this single galaxy that we're in, the home galaxy. They affirm that it contains many, many worlds, and as we now know, many Earth-like planets. That's right, isn't it?
Right.
Astronomers
right.
have discovered Earth-like planets. It contains many, but they made a remarkable statement, and that statement was that the Earth, the planet that we inhabit, is the one of many Earth-like planets inhabited by strains of humanity that has a unique situation, because after the gods conceive and imagine these divine experiments in life and these experiments in civilization that unfold in the planetary worlds, they do not get involved in these experiments. Their role is like scientists who do not meddle with the experiment that they've set in motion, because if they meddle with the experiment, it's not pure anymore. They just watch it unfold.
It reminds me of Star Trek, where they can't interfere with these worlds that they are visiting. Interesting.
Well, this concept of Star Trek has been floating around, and it's used. It's been discussed by some people who are discussing UFO theories, and it is a concept you find in the Gnostic teachings that the eons in the galactic center generally remain detached from these experiments, but with one particular eon, whose name was Sophia, something really extraordinary happened. And that is that she became so enamored and so fascinated and so intrigued by what the human species could do. And the human species was genomically projected from the galactic center on a number of threads. You know? She was so excited that she plunged from the galactic center into the external structure of the galaxy. This is called the Fall of Sophia. And it's a main theme in this myth that I reconstructed. You'll find the myth, by the way, told in 9 episodes on my website, metahistory.org. And
okay.
You can also find it told in my book, Not in His Image. I've told it, the whole thing, in 9 episodes. It's quite a long and complex myth. It's not something that you can tell in just 5 minutes, but its complexity is beautiful. And it's also, I want to emphasize this, and we'll get to this, I hope, at another point in this conversation. It's a myth of participation. In other words, when you know the story of this goddess who fell from the center of heaven and actually turned into our planet, she is embodied in this planet, then you understand that her story is ongoing. This myth has not been finished. We are involved in the continuation and completion of her story. And this is a wonderful, wonderful discovery that I had the privilege of making through my studies in comparative mythology.
So, I guess where I'm getting a little bit confused is, did you get this? Well, you said you got it from comparative mythology, but also, but how did the non-Kamadi, come in? I mean, or do they overlap, or is there a parallel there?
No, the non-Kamadi contains a version of a goddess mythology, okay? You've read many goddess mythologies, right? It contains a version of goddess mythology. I promise you this. You will not find anything like it anywhere else, because the version that the Gnostics taught is a complete story of the origin of our planet and the origin of the human species and our role in the divine biography of this sacred feminine being. And that is only found, as far as I know, in a complete version in these Gnostic writings. So that's what makes it special. You can't infer this or develop this from comparative mythology alone. It comes from that one source.
Okay, so it's almost like I can just see these eons are just watching us in this petri dish.
Mm-hmm. Sort of, yeah, if you want to use a scientific analogy. Actually, they're much more compassionate than that. They're more watching us like we would watch someone playing a game or doing a beautiful performance of art. There is a scientific aspect to it, but they have enormous empathy for the creatures who emerge in these experiments of ours. The remarkable thing about the divine Sophia is she was called prunikos, which is this wonderful word in Greek, prunikos, which means outrageous. It's called outrageous because she did something that was completely outrageous. That is, she fell away from the galactic center, and she became involved in the very experiment that she had projected. And this is a unique situation, so I understand, a unique situation for the Earth. And this is why the goddess mythology and our direct experience of the goddess is absolutely essential to the future of this planet.
So where do we take it from here, though? That all sounds wonderful, and yes, it's a different take on the goddess story, a new take. But what do you see as next? What's the next step?
Well, one of the ways to get to the next step is to ask this question. what does she, I'm going to call her the Divine Sophia, if that's okay with you.
Mm-hmm.
There's another term that I use in my book and in my website. I kind of coined this term, I think. I sometimes call her Gaia Sophia, Gaia hyphen Sophia. Mm-hmm. I use the term pronunciation Sophia rather than Sophia to distinguish her name from the name of a common name of a woman. So let's say that Gaia Sophia, let's say that we just understand the general meaning of this story, okay? I haven't told you the whole nine episodes, which are absolutely fantastic. I mean, it is, to my mind, the most complex and beautiful and revealing myth that I've ever discovered in my studies. But let's just say we have the general idea that Gaia Sophia is the name we give to the earth, to the divine feminine, when we recognize that the earth is the embodiment of a being from the galactic center. Okay? Let's just set that up as a kind of a rule.
I'm seeing all the Christians' hair go light on fire, but go ahead.
Yeah, well, I would like, you know, they may all light on fire as well. Burn up to Rice Krispies, as far as I'm concerned. But don't get me going on that. Now,
I think we're probably on on the same page, but go ahead.
There is a beautiful passage, two beautiful passages in the episodes, the nine episodes I write, and they describe how she actually emerged. And you can visualize this. This is a myth that you must picture in your mind. And if you want some help with that, you can look at Jay Widener's DVD, Sophia Returning, in which there is kind of a partial retelling of this myth. And he uses some montage to illustrate how to visualize it. You know, the galactic center is like this beautiful core of white light that's full of rainbow colors. And the structure of this light and the substance of this light is the great seers of the mysteries told us is like nougat. This light is actually a substance. It's like liquid pearl or nougat. And the way that to describe what happened when Sophia plunged out of the galactic center toward the limbs of the galaxy is that a plume or spike of this organic light shot away from the galactic center straight out into the limbs, you know, the four circulating arms. And then what happened was that at its end, at its extreme point of the plume, it began to darken and materialize and eventually shaped itself into a globe, and that globe became the Earth. There's a remarkable thing that I learned from this creation myth, and I'll just put it out because it's wonderful to say it. And when I say it, I'm aware that many people may never have heard this idea before. The mystics of the mystery schools, who were actual seers, who could look at the galactic center, who could see into time, and who could report this story to us, they claimed that the Earth is actually not a part of the solar system.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. They claimed that the Earth, which is the only living planet in the solar system, organically alive, with beings living on its surface, is actually captured in the solar system, but does not really belong to the solar system as such.
So we're the aliens.
In a way, you could say we are. We are certainly not like the other aliens who live in the other part of the solar system.
We're not indigenous to the solar system.
In a way, we're not. We are not. We are only indigenous to the Earth, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, to get to my point, you ask me, how do you get involved once you know the story? I mean, this is really the key message that I can give you here, and this is all that I want to say and all that the love in me has to say, is that as you learn about her story, you may be compelled to get involved in her story. One thing that I often say is that what is it to love another human being? You know, think about the people you love in your life. In my experience, I can just say this. The people that I have loved, the individual people, I know the story of their lives as if it was my own. Do you know?
Mm-hmm. You know them intimately, you mean.
You know them well.
You know them intimately. I think that's...
I don't know them intimately as a person, Karen. I know the story of their lives as deeply as they do. I could tell you the story of the life of someone I know, just like they themselves could tell it to you.
Okay.
And to me, love is the experience in which you enshrine the life of another person in your heart, and the life of that person is sacred to you. That's love to me. That's deep personal love. Well, it's no different with her. It's no different with the planetary animal mother, Sophia. If you want to know her and be involved with her, then you love her story, and you know her story and enshrine it in your heart, just like you would of a person that you know. And one of the things about her story, there are various elements about her story that refer to the past, the history of the solar system, the presence of alien and ETs in our world. This is explained in her story. The way the solar system was captured in the celestial clockworks of the planetary system, or the way the Earth was captured, rather. And then there are things in her story that refer to the present and the future. And, of course, those are the parts of her story that we want to know really deeply, because that's where we get involved, and that's where we can do something, not just in personal reality, but probably in a social and global reality. So how do we get to that involvement? Well, one thing we can do is we can ask, what does she, Gaia Sophia, think of us? How does she view us?
Can you answer that?
Sure. According to my understanding of this magnificent myth, she views us as a novel experiment of the gods. And in certain ways, we are a kind of pet species to her. But I want to qualify that statement very, very carefully. We're not superior to any of her other species. Now, when Gaia looks at the human species as a whole, or when she looks at an individual like you and me, and she can do that, she doesn't view us as superior to bees or beavers or whales, but she views us as privileged and exceptionally gifted in one particular capacity, and that is the capacity that she herself endowed in us. And that is the capacity for novelty and play and the ability to excel in acts of beauty and pleasure. This is how she views the human species.
Interesting.
This is my understanding, not only based on the study of this myth and my own dedication to this myth, but also based on my conversations with Sophia. With my the results of my experimental mysticism, as it were.
So if you can kind of grasp that. Would you say from your experience of her, from your, if I can call it, communication or insights gleaned, is she disappointed with the grand experiment?
I knew you were going to use that word because that is exactly the word that comes up by suggestion of what I said, isn't it? Because if we regard ourselves as she regards us, wouldn't we be disappointed with ourselves?
Well, I think so.
Yeah. I mean, if we are a species who is here with the whales and the dolphins and the eagles and the snakes and the bees, and they all have their instinctual programs, and how wonderful are their programs. These programs, instinctual programs of the animals, are all creations of Sophia's imagination. Do you know that? They're all creations of her artwork, of her own mind, and they're expressions of her love of creation. And then there's the human species. And look at us. She endows us with imagination, with the capacity to love, to learn, to explore, to experiment, that surpasses any of the other animals We have more latitude to play than any animal, and animals all love to play. We have more latitude to play. Yeah, and look at what we've done with it. So the real question is, I would suspect, that she is disappointed with us, but certainly we need to take a really good look at ourselves. And yet, not in a negative sense, because I believe that if we know what she thinks of us, and we can know it in the framework of this unique myth, then we shall be able to set a standard for ourselves that is consistent with her mind and consistent with the beauty of her perception. She is all about beauty. If you were to ask me, what does Gaia want? I would tell you, she wants one thing of us, to live in beauty. That's it.
Well, that's an interesting way to phrase it, and I'm trying to wrap my mind around it, because if we did live in beauty, then all of these other isms that plague us, sexism, elitism, and all the phobias, and it would all just go away.
It would melt away. It would melt away. You can see that. There is some deep sense in us that knows that, and that knows that beauty is her highest standard, because look at her. Look at her. How can you not love her for her beauty? Just for starters, Then when you get into her mind, then when you converse with her, I mean intimately, and I want to tell the people who are listening to this interview that you can talk to Gaia. You can talk to the Divine Sophia as the planet directly. Now, everyone may talk to the goddess in their own soul, in their own imagination, any way they like, and I'm not invalidating that, and I'm not saying that what I suggest is better than that, but I'm saying that it's an option that you might consider. One thing that you and I cannot do, just let me say this, please, and then I would love to hear your response. We know that our body is composed of about 200 million cells, which is sort of compared sometimes to the 200 million stars in the galaxy. And yet as I stand here at this computer and you stand there and all your listeners stand there in their bodies composed of cells, not one of us can communicate with a single one of our cells, can we? Normally.
I'd say most people would probably say no.
Right. But Gaia, the planetary animal mother, can communicate with her cells individually. And since we are just cells in her body, that means that you can have a one-on-one, person-to-person encounter and meeting with her, and she will talk to you, and you can talk to her. And this is done under certain conditions, which are not difficult to achieve, but I have been trying to outline those conditions in my recent work on planetary tantra, which I've been developing since my book came out a few years ago.
Well, I can literally, I can just imagine the listeners out there want me to say to you, okay, John, how do we make this connection? Tell us how you have figured out, a way for us to reach Sophia, so that she hears us.
Okay. I would love to do that, and I will give it my best shot. But first, I have to make a little disclaimer.
Okay.
Okay? I have not been happy in certain ways with my delivery of the Sophia message. I am absolutely delighted and feel so honored and privileged to be a person who can present this myth. But I just discovered this myth. I didn't make it up. But because of the supreme and paramount value of this myth, I risk sometimes sounding like I'm authoritarian and like, okay, it's my way or the highway, okay? I honestly ask you to be patient with me and give me the consideration that I'm really not coming from there, although I might sound that way. It's not a question of is it my way or the highway. It's a question of is it's her way or no way.
Okay. Well,
and
first of all, you're not coming across. You're not coming across that way. You know, I mean, I'm hearing you as someone who has something to share. And, you know, if it sounds like something that feels authentic and real and valuable, then, you know, then we're listening. You know, we learn from each other, you know, and you're the teacher today. So, you know, we're happy to have you enlighten us.
Well, thank you very much. You really put me at ease with that in a gracious way. So now I will forge on. In this planetary tantra that I am teaching, I have a certain role. I'm the teacher of planetary tantra, as you just noted, but I also consider myself to be a chirtan. And I don't know if you've heard that word, chirtan.
Would it say it again, please?
T-E-R-T-O-N, chirtan.
Okay, no, what is it?
The chirtan is a word from Tibetan Buddhism, and it means a treasure finder.
Okay.
Yeah. So you can read about chirtans. You can Google the word, T-E-R-T-O-N. They're a big deal in Nyingma tradition and Tibetan Buddhism. And chirtans are seers and shamans in the Buddhist tradition who discover certain wisdom treasures, which are called termas. And these treasures are generally understood to be given to them from what is called the divinely arising Dakini wisdom, which is another way of describing the genius of the divine feminine. So chirtans are people who receive, as it were, kind of revelations or teachings. So what I'm going to communicate now is a teaching that I actually discovered that was given to me in a way, and it's less my construction than it is a discovery that I had. And it's also an open source construction. That means that anyone can participate in it. It's not defined by the person who happens to be putting it out. The essence of planetary tantra shows how to participate intimately with the goddess Gaia Sophia, and there are four steps to doing this. Four simple steps. You could sort of call them the rules of engagement. The first step is to say her name.
That's easy enough?
No, it isn't. Because
it's a secret name?
Not exactly. It's not exactly a secret name, but there are many, many names that we can say and call the goddess by, right?
Right.
Many. We could list them. There are hundreds of them. But what I discovered in this planetary tantra experience is that there is one particular name that she answers to directly. In other words, there is one name that has a resonance and a power to bring her attention to you. Go back to this analogy that I gave about being a cell. Suppose that I wanted to talk to a cell in my liver, one particular cell. In magical terms, if I knew the name of that particular cell, the name that it calls itself by, that is, if I knew a particular resonance frequency, I could pronounce that name, and that cell would know that I am addressing it. So there is such a name for the Divine Sophia. And the practice begins by saying her name aloud, screaming it actually, out in nature, calling her like you would call an animal. That's the first part of the practice.
The
name by the way.
So are we calling her Sophia?
No, that's not the name you call.
Okay.
That's who you're calling, but you have to call her by her Dakini name.
Okay.
And you go out into the forest in wild nature where people won't come and arrest you as a terrorist because they hear you screaming your lungs out. And you scream, and the reason why you scream is like it's like calling for an animal because she is like an animal. The planet is a great animal. She responds like an animal. So imagine that you went out into the forest somewhere and you had lost your dog and you're just yelling and calling the name of your dog. I mean, the dog knows its name and it will come. So she will respond if you call her Dakini name. Now, I don't say this name now on this broadcast because it's a sacred name. It's on the website, but I don't usually say it in social discourse.
Okay.
Second thing is there is a vow. Once you've called her name, and it's interesting to do that, see what happens, by the way. Several people have indicated to me that some very interesting things can occur when you do that, is to make a vow to her. And generally I recommend that people do this in couples. You go out and you compose a vow to her, telling her, and you read this vow together, two people is better than one, telling her what you commit to her and how you want to involve your life with her in a sacred commitment. So you make the vow to her. The third practice is to learn her story. This you can learn from reading it on metahistory.org or in my book, Not in His Image. And as I said, there are 9 episodes in the story, and you learn it like you would learn the story of the life of a person you love. Learn her story, hold it in your heart. Those 3 steps are the foundation of planetary tantra.
Okay, but you said there were 4.
And the fourth one is, excuse me, yeah, fourth one is really important. And that is to register in your mind what is the organic light.
What is the organic light? Is that what you said?
Yeah, what is the organic light?
Okay, what is the organic light?
What is the organic light? Organic light is a phenomenon in the atmosphere of the Earth that was observed by these ancient mystics in the mystery schools. I assume that many of your readers would know what the great mystery schools were of the ancient pagan world, you know? It was a vast network of spiritual universities consisting of cells of mystics, men and women in groups of 8 and 16. And they worked together and they experimented together in altered states, sometimes using psychoactive plants, sometimes doing it through dance, sometimes through sex, sometimes through chanting and music, and sometimes just through the concentration of their minds. They were shamanic experts, highly sophisticated. And they observed collectively over many generations a particular phenomenon. Now, of course, if you're a mystic, if you're a psychonaut, if you've taken sacred plants, you've had many different experiences of light. And even if you haven't done that, you probably have had dramatic and deeply moving experiences of light in their life. I would say most everyone has, wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there is one experience and one phenomenon of light which is unique, and that is called the organic light. Now, this light is a property of the galactic center that emerges in the atmosphere of the Earth due to the embodiment of Sophia in the material elements of the Earth. The Gnostic myth tells us that the earth we see, which is with our senses, consists of air, water, the oceans, air, the sky, the clouds, fire, the warmth of the earth, volcanoes, earth, the mountains, the land, and that these material elements are actually morphs. They are metamorphoses of the organic light, which is the primary substance body of this goddess. Thus, she has 2 bodies, as you behold, right in front of you. One of them is her material body, her sensory body, which is the planet itself. The planet is the body of the divine Sophia, fell from the galactic center. This is what the myth says. But there is a second way to see her, and that is to see the pure light which she is and ever was, because she is the pure light of the galactic center at the same time that she is the visible planet. So the supreme mystical encounter for these Gnostics was to meet the organic light. And I've written a lot about this. If you go to the search button on metahistory.org and put in organic light, you'll see I've described it. It is a remarkable light that cannot be mistaken for anything else in mystical experience for 2 reasons. One is because it wells up from within material things. Think about that for a moment. It radiates out of material things. It does not shine through the empty atmosphere. Secondly, it behaves like a living thing, like an animal. It will respond to you. You can converse with it. This is described in the Gnostic texts. conversations with the organic light are actually recorded in some of these Gnostic texts. And thirdly, it has no shadow. It casts no shadow. It's a soft, marshmallow-like light. And finally, and this is a very delightful thing that might intrigue some of you, it can taste you.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Just imagine a big lion, you know.
Licking you.
Yeah, imagine a big, big lion and the power and beauty of that animal coming up to you and licking you to taste you. This light will taste you. And I'm not making this up. I've had this experience many times, and I know other people who have had it as well. So before you encounter the organic light, and the question of how to do that would be a whole other conversation, it's really important to register that it exists, you know? There are certain global realities that are extremely important to us now. In order to have this global shift, we need to know what global warming is, you know? We need to know what the ozone layer is, you know? And in terms of the myth of Sophia, we need to know what the organic light is, because that is the gateway into her presence. And when you encounter that light and learn to routinely and repeatedly meet it, you can have conversations with her.
I am just thinking how this would blow so many minds. And also too, you know, the more I listen to you, you know, I'm feeling like we have just gotten watered down versions, little shadows or glimmers of some of these ideas, you know, have sort of trickled down, but not the full potency of it as you're describing it here. Does that make any
sense?
Well,
thank you, Karen. Thank you so much, Karen, so much for speaking that way. This is the full impact, as far as I know, in my humble opinion. And it gets back to the point that we began our conversation with, you know. There are many ways to come into the shift, and people are feeling it, if not just out of sheer desperation, you know, if nothing else. But to enter the shift in the highest inspiration and in real intimacy, this is the path, as far as I know. This is the gateway. Her story, her name. You make a sacred commitment to her, and you prepare yourself to meet this light. And these are the initial practices of planetary tantra, as I've been beginning to understand it.
So, John, how would you say this changes one's life? I have a lot of questions, but the first one would be, how has, you know, if you don't mind me asking you personally, or you can just speak in general sense from, you know, your colleagues, how does it change one when they recognize and can communicate with the organic light?
Beautiful question. Thank you so much for asking that. I will speak from my personal experience and allow you to extrapolate as you see fit, okay?
Mm-hmm.
In my personal experience, many, many things in my life were deeply changed by this intimacy with her story and encountering the organic light. Primarily, what I found was that over a period of time, the first thing that I discovered was that my priorities were absolutely changed. And it wasn't as if I even had to sort them out myself. They got sorted out for me. Every time I experienced this organic light or entered into this magnificent aura of her presence, I came away and found that my priorities were changed. How I wanted to live, what was important to me, what mattered to me materially, personally, emotionally, professionally, creatively, goes under a tremendous metamorphosis. But the amazing thing about it, Karen, is that it happens like by itself. You don't actually have to work at it. Somehow the impact of this light engenders these tremendous reshifting of priorities in your life.
So do the priorities just change in your life, or do circumstances also change serendipitously, shall we say, that enable you to follow these new priorities?
Both. The priorities change, and sometimes there is amazing serendipity accompanying that immediately within hours, you know. And then sometimes, just because I'm living from a different priority, the circumstances of my life just take a different direction, you see. So it works like that. There is a kind of magic about it. I would describe that. The second thing I noticed is that my experience of my own body became more and more ecstatic, that I realized that I was just sitting at the beach yesterday with my companion, Sabina, and we were, it's a beautiful day down there, and she was painting, and I was saying, you know, there are two things in the world that I love more than anything else. The first one is my own body, and the second one is hers. You know, I don't mean Sabina's, I mean Gaia's, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I just love my body, and I love this planet as a body, and then all the other love I feel just sort of is swept into that. You know what I mean? All the other love I feel for other bodies and other things is swept into that. So I found that my love of my body, my love of my senses, of everything that I see, touch, taste, eat, smell, became so intensified that I was in close to an ecstatic state most of the time. Then I found that I could participate in my body much more deeply, that I could know really sensitive to when it feels well, to when it's telling me it's not feeling well, that my communication was of my body became deeper, and I felt very happy then because it gave me a sense of security, you know, about my health and my well-being. Then I would say the third thing that happened was I began to become much more aware of what magic means in her terms. Magic in her terms. That is to say that the magic of my life, which fulfills itself every day, every single day in some remarkable way, is based on my relationship to her. That is the baseline.
Well, a couple questions here for you. Let's start with starting with magic in her terms.
Mm-hmm.
Give me an example or two of magic in her terms.
Okay. One example of magic in her terms is that in the practice of planetary tantra, I use this tool. There is a tool for this practice, and I use this tool called the Shakti Cluster, and it's described on metahistory.org. And the Shakti Cluster is like a mandala or a configuration of 18 points. And these 18 points can all be named and given a particular goddess name. 10 of these points are named, and these names are provisional, by the way. They don't absolutely have to be retained, but they're the names to introduce you to this system. 10 of the names are names of Hindu goddesses called the Mahavidyas, the 10 Mahavidyas that are aspects of Kali. Have you heard of them?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The 10 Mahavidyas are 10 points of this, and the other 8 points are 8 powerful dakinis. And so I call this Shakti Cluster the Tantric Tree of Life, because it's very similar to the Kabbalistic Tree of Life with the Sephira. Each of the nodes of the Shakti Cluster, each of the 18 nodes, is a channel into the Divine Feminine. Our interface, what I've discovered is that our interface with the Divine Feminine has 18 channels that she transmits on. And you can experience each one of these channels through the qualities and powers of that particular dakini.
Wow.
For instance, one of the channels of the Shakti Cluster is the Shodashi, whose name means 16. She's one of the Mahavidyas. Another one is of a Mahavidya called, Kamala, as a goddess of love and desire. And this is how the magic works. Magic works in the tantric, planetary tantric sense, by preparing your imagination for a step. So you read about that particular goddess. You look at her image. You absorb knowledge of her functions. Or it might be a Buddhist dakini, like Vajrayogini, you know, Dorje Phagma. You steep yourself in the lore of that goddess and enshrine her in your imagination. And then you go out and look at the sky. Just look at the sky. When you empty your mind as much as you can, you just look at the sky. And in the sky, through the sky, and in the interaction between the sky and your mind, you will experience something that shows you the actual action of that dakini. She will, in some sense, appear. I don't mean this in a literal sense. I don't want to be too literal-minded here. She doesn't necessarily appear as a hallucination, although she can. But she will present herself to you through one of these 18 channels. So a lot of the practice that I do is learning how to actually play with, recognize and play with the frequencies of these 18 wild, extravagant divinities of Gaia. That is the practice of Dakini magic.
Well, it's interesting that you're sort of overlapping Gnosticism with Hindu goddesses. Does that seem strange?
Yes, I am. Well, I'll tell you what happened. I'm so glad you asked that question. I got to the point after I wrote Not in His Image. It came out in 2007. And I did my best job to, first of all, show the mistake, and it's really the atrocious mistake and disinformation of many scholars, such as Elaine Pagels and others. And I know Elaine, and I've spoken with her, and I like her, and I respect her. But unfortunately, she and other feminist scholars of Gnosticism have been making a terrible mistake that they consider Gnosticism to be just kind of an outtake of early Christianity.
Okay.
You know?
Okay.
That is not the case at all, according to John Lash. You know, I tried to correct that error in my book, Not in His Image, and I show that Gnosticism is the remnant of the purest pagan goddess religion that you can imagine. The purest pagan goddess spirituality is found in these Gnostic teachings. And so after I wrote the book, I was pretty satisfied that I'd done an okay job. But people were asking me, well, John, where are you going to go now? How can we explore this Gnostic message about the goddess more extensively? And there I faced a very serious problem. Because anyone who reads into Gnosticism will find, especially if you go into the Coptic texts, you know, it's an atrocious mess. Coptic is a really bad language. It's not even a real language. It's kind of a made-up language. And the terminology in these Gnostic, Coptic, and Greek writings is very poor, very impoverished. So I faced this problem. I thought, how are we going to develop the Gnostic mythology and the message of the Divine Sophia more richly and expansively? Because if we keep it limited to the Gnostic texts where I discovered it, we will be frustrated, you see? The place where it's discovered is not sufficient for its extrapolation, you see?
Right.
So then I came up with this idea, which I call the tantric conversion. And this is, you'll find this on metahistory.org. This is why I created the section of metahistory.org called Planetary Tantra. I began it with two essays called the tantric conversion. What is the tantric conversion? Very simple. Take the Greek word sophia. It means wisdom, right?
Right.
Correct.
It's in the word philosophy. Philosophy means love of wisdom, philo sophia. Okay, now go to Sanskrit. You know about Greek-Sanskrit parallels. Very important aspect of comparative mythology is Greek-Sanskrit parallels. Go from the Greek sophia to Sanskrit. What's the correlative term? Correlative term is vidya. Sanskrit term vidya has in it the root vid, V-I-D. That is the root of the word Vedas, Vedanta. It's also the root of the English word wisdom. The root of the English word wisdom is V-I-D with the D turned to an S. Wisdom, wit, Vedanta, which means spiritual knowledge. That is the Hindu Sanskrit and Buddhist equivalent to sophia. So I thought, fantastic. I'm just going to use that conversion. And I'm going to talk about all the Hindu and Buddhist goddesses in the sophia framework.
Wow. I'll never think about Gnosticism the same.
Well, thank you so much, because that is exactly my mission, and now, you know, now I have achieved it. I was sleep well this morning knowing I have achieved my mission. I said, when I write this book, Not in His Image, I am going to turn everything that people have heard about Gnosticism entirely inside out. And
another point. I mean, I was just teaching Cakes for the Queen of Heaven to, you know, sort of a beginner class, and we were
just
on the.
What that was. Excuse me for talking over you. What is Cakes for the Queen of Heaven?
Cakes for the Queen of Heaven is a feminist theology curriculum put together by the Unitarian Universalist women about 20 years ago, but it still very much stands the test of time. And it's a 13-class course that starts with, you know, women realizing the sacredness of their body, you know, the timeline of goddess that she's worshipped, you know, at least 30 or 40,000 years ago. You know, it goes into, women power and how women have been oppressed and how they're not, you know, there's no female voice in the Bible. It's like if you took Rhianne Eisler and Merlin Stone and Starhawk and a lot of these other folks and sort of compressed everything, you can do this 13-week curriculum instead of reading 50 books, you know. So it gives somebody a really good foundation for feminist theology and goddess history. And
well, that's fabulous.
Yeah, it is. It is really good, and it's a shame that it's not used more today. I think it's sort of faded out, but I'm doing everything I can to reawaken it, because it is so very important, and it's a really good starting point for people, and even not even a starting point, but. Where I was going with this was, we were, one of the last classes was on Mary Magdalene, and they brought up the idea of Gnosticism, and they were talking about Gnosticism, you know, within Gnosticism, you go searching for God. God is within. God is not, you know, external. But the point that we didn't really, we felt like the Gnostics, at least as it was being presented in this curriculum, they had totally, not included, excluded the body connection. It was like it was all in the head, and I don't know. I'm just, you know, as I'm hearing you speak, I'm feeling like there's, you know, this isn't all in the head. This is very much a body connection too.
This is totally a body connection. And to get back to what you asked me about. How involvement with this story and how the recognition of the organic light changes your life. As I said, this is a bodily involvement. This is so deep. It runs so deep. I mean, I could talk about this for hours. It really involves the iron in the blood and the connection between the iron in your blood and the iron in the magnetic field of the earth, you know? That's what Kali is really about. Kali is the mistress of the age of iron, right? Kali Yuga is the age of iron. And although that is the age, in many respects, when the human species really degenerates, it's the age when we lose the plot, when everything sacred becomes violated, when nobody knows the truth anymore. It's the age of fraud. It's the age when the worst people prevail and the best people are suppressed. But in that age, the legend says, the supreme opportunity for liberation is given by Kali. And this liberation is a liberation into a connection. It's not a liberation from the earth or from embodiment, it is, or from material things. It is a liberation into the ecstatic connection with everything that lives. It is totally embodied. You know, there was so much disinformation, Karen, about Mary Magdalene. I spent like 20 years of my life on that front. If you go to Meta History and you check the, there's a whole section on Magdalene, but if you also check the essay called Kundalini and the Alien Force, in this I quote extensively from the Gospel of Philip. You know, that's one of the Nag Hammadi texts, mm-hmm. one of the longer mm-hmm. ones. And the Gospel of Philip is actually contains some fantastic secrets of tantric sexual magic, which are framed in the relationship of Magdalene and Jesus, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, there are things, I have to tell you, there are things that no scholar would tell you, that no scholar, even the women scholars who have interpreted Gnosticism, would get anywhere near, because they are so outrageous and lurid. You know, there is a fragment from a Gnostic, Greek Gnostic text that actually describes a Jesus figure. Now, we're not talking about a literal historical Jesus here, okay? We don't know who that was, right? So right. saying some kind of Jesus as a Gnostic, right?
Right.
A Jesus figure going with Mary Magdalene to a mountaintop and showing her, you know, the secrets of oral sex and how we become magically empowered by ingesting sexual fluids. Now, like, what Gnostic scholar is going to tell you about that passage, you know?
Right.
And it's my understanding of two things about Mary Magdalene. One is that the true pagan Gnostics who revered the divine feminine, as we do, held her to be the embodiment of Sophia, but only as an example of what any woman could be, or any man.
Mm-hmm.
So to the extent that any of us can be an embodiment of Sophia's wisdom, we are a Magdalene. Second thing is that they represented her as a great teacher of tantric secrets and of how to construct, in particular, what is called the nymphion. The nymphion is a word in the Gospel of Philip, which means, scholars translate it as bridal chamber, you know,
mm-hmm.
because the word nymphe means bride, okay? But actually what the bridal chamber was is a cell of light, a kind of globule formed in the organic light by a couple who are practicing tantric sex. And so the knowledge of the secrets of sacred sexuality and its connection of the earth was absolutely profound among these people. And Christianity and every other religion that came down the pike had to destroy that, because the best way to disempower a person is to disempower their sexuality.
Well, you're making me think about so many different things. Glimmers and a shadow, I think, of what you're talking about, you know, how, you know, in sexual union, that's how man would reach the divine, you know, but they don't
that's
really
right.
elaborate on that. You know, you're talking about this elusive interconnection. You know, we all
mm-hmm.
talk about, well, we've lost that. You know, we've lost that interconnection with each other, with the planet. Again, you're bringing that back in. You know, when you talked about, you know, when I think you said when you know the organic light, I think you said that, you know, you brought up the idea of love and that intense mm-hmm. love you had for yourself, your body, the earth. That made me think about how Jesus was supposed to be about love, and I've always thought Jesus was probably a Gnostic.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it all just sort of fits together, because if people really did connect with this organic light and liberate themselves with this love for themselves, for the planet, then it's like none of this other bullshit would matter, you know? I mean,
that's
it would
right.
almost be like they would be blissed out on this connection.
True. And one thing that I've learned, and I have to say, getting back to maybe adding a further answer to your dream question about how this has affected my life and made my life more magical, tell you one way that it's really affected me is that in the way that I think about love, you know? Now, I used to think that I was a pretty loving person, and maybe I was, I don't know, it's for other people to say, not me, you know? And I used to think that I knew what love was, because I have had in my life some very intense experiences of personal love. I have to say that I haven't really experienced what some people would call, you know, transpersonal love so much, like a sweeping sense of love for humanity, you know? Personally, I have to say, my love has been really for particular individuals. And so what I've learned, and this has been a huge transformation for me, is that, you know, I never think of love anymore alone. Now, when I think of love, my syntax, my emotional syntax is entirely different. It's always love and pleasure. And it's my pleasure to tell you that Gaia is all about pleasure. And
well,
that
and that's,
pleasure for her is the transcendent. It is the transcendent as much as love is.
Well, and of course, that's something Christians, you know, beat out of us too and made us feel what was taboo and dirty and, you know, the whole
thing.
Well,
that was the most threatening thing to them about the pagan way of life, you know, is that the pagan way of life is an ethos of pleasure. It's an ethos of hedonism, but it's a very sane ethos of hedonism, you know. Do you know who Dolores La Chapelle was?
No.
No, Dolores La Chapelle used to live in Colorado, in that wonderful little town, Telluride, and I call her the doyen, or the great shining light of deep ecology, Dolores La Chapelle, L-A-C-H-A-P-E-L-L-E. She should be listed with Merlin Stone and Maria Gimbutas and Diane Volkstein, really. She's right up there. And Dolores La Chapelle was a great revivalist and had a great understanding of this essential pagan viewpoint, which is that when we live in beauty and when we live in the pleasure of our lives, it's very difficult to do wrong or hurt anyone. There is no pleasure in hurting. So the pleasure that people get from hurting comes from the perversion of their souls. But essentially, there is no pleasure in hurting. So the corollary is, if you live in pleasure, you're not going to harm. And that is that drove the Christians out of their minds, because they wanted to impose a theocratic program that said, no, there's a reward and punishment system here, and forget this pleasure business, you know. And so they really went for the throat. And, you know, they not only murdered and drove away the great pagans and mystics of the mystery schools, but they also destroyed almost down to the last volume every single work that they had written.
Well, you're probably familiar. I mean, if you're over in Europe, you're familiar, I would imagine, with that movie that came out about Hypatia, Agora.
I've heard about it, but I didn't see it. Yeah.
Well, it was really interesting because, it made, you know, when I read the opening chapter of your book and having just seen that movie a few weeks ago, well, it was banned here in the United States. The distributors actually said because they were worried about the Christian backlash. But it was so well received in Europe. It started, I think they said it started being shown in Spain, some hotshot Spanish filmmaker who everybody really loves made the movie.
Almodovar. That would be Almodovar. He's a very heretical Spanish filmmaker who challenges sexual taboos. Would be him, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, apparently this won the equivalent of the European Academy Award. And anyway, they
really?
Show in the – I mean, it's a wonderful film. If you get a chance to see it, try to see it. It's finally opened here in the United States, at least in Los Angeles and New York. But I'm listening to what you're saying, and at the same time, you know, making all of these other, you know, connections, you know, with Christians and teachings. And anyway, in the movie, they show you when the Christians who look, you know, who are dirty and toothless and in these, you know,
right.
these black dirty robes storm
right.
the Serapeum.
That's right.
You know, which and of course it's beautiful and colorful and rich and lush. You know,
it was. Yeah.
And what the filmmaker actually did was he took the camera. It was so brilliant, I thought. He took the camera and literally flipped the whole scene upside down. So you literally, very viscerally, felt like the world had just turned on its head.
Yeah,
you know.
It sure did.
And I mean, and that's what happened. I mean, everything was just reversed and turned on its head, and, you know, we end up going into the Dark Ages, and it just makes you wonder if the pagans had prevailed, you know, what life on this planet may have been like. I mean, you know, I'm sure we would have had our problems, but I
sure.
can't help
of course we would have had a problem.
But I can't help but imagine that it had to be better than this, with the Crusades and the fatwas and the Inquisitions and the, you know, and the oppression of women and the homophobia and on and on and on, you know. I mean, you know, Christianity has been like a plague on the planet, and I know that...
It is a plague. It was called the plague at the time.
Was it really? I'll
say this in my book. Yeah, it was called a pest and a plague by pagans at the time. One of the reasons why they objected to it was they considered it a form of insanity, and for a very particular reason. Is because what they saw in a Christian redemptive theology, which is also present in Judaism and Islam, is what they saw is that there is a divine being who suffers, and the suffering of that being redeems and saves the world. And by extension, the implication is, this is how I phrase it, well, there is a redemptive value in suffering, whether it be the suffering of the divine being that has a supreme redemptive value, saves the world, and there's a redemptive value in our suffering too, you know? Well,
yeah.
The pagans looked at that and they said, this is totally insane. There is no redemptive value in suffering from the pagan viewpoint. You can make something out of suffering. You can turn it around. You can learn from it if you're strong enough. But to imply that there is a redemptive value intrinsically in suffering is sick. And this was pointed out by the pagan Gnostics and even by non-Gnostics and pagan philosophers. And, you know, the Christians really didn't like that because that was cutting to the core of their program, because they glorify suffering. They glorify Christianity and these the religions of redemption glorify the victim-perpetrator bond. This is the point I make in the first part of my book. And they put it in the place of our rapturous bond of pleasure and beauty with the earth and with each other. And if you do that to a species, you drive them down the road to self-destruction and insanity. And, you know, there's a lot to explain of how we got there, where we are today, a lot.
Well, John, to explain to me, I understand, Constantine used Christianity as a glue to solidify the nation and, you know, his country and all of that. But why would people, I can't understand this mindset. Why would they give up what paganism offered them for this? I mean, was it
Yeah, well,
all,
they didn't give it up. Yeah. They didn't
well,
give
I mean,
it up
I know a lot
terrible.
Of it was by force, but, I mean, why would
yeah.
you... I don't know. I guess it's like they didn't have a choice. I mean, it wasn't like it just seems like Christianity just totally, you know, in time ruled the day. And I guess I'm just surprised that there wasn't more of a fight, or it just doesn't seem like there was much of a fight. Or is that just looking at things
from
the Christian lens?
Don't forget that the history of the triumph of Christianity is told from the viewpoint of the winners. And we're very, you know, we're not told often of about how much resistance it there was. We know, though, there are certain things that all scholars kind of repeat in a kind of a mindless way without realizing how important they are. For instance, scholars often say, well, look at these great cathedrals and look at Christian art. And isn't it interesting how much pagan symbolism and pagan belief survives under the facade of Christianity? Well, of course. Because you can't wipe out the intrinsic and indigenous religion of a people connected to the earth and the sanctity of their own bodies overnight. It took a tremendous effort to do that. A lot of my book is looking at your question. I mean, it's not an easy question to tackle. But a lot of my book at the beginning and at the end addresses this question. And all I can say to those who might want to look at God in his image is that I do something in there that no one else has done, as far as I know. Many of you in the United States know about recovery, adult child work, the whole recovery movement, John Bradshaw, things like that. And you've probably heard in that context about abuse bonding. You know what abuse bonding is? It's when a child who's beaten or a wife who's mistreated becomes bonded to the perpetrator, to the person who's abusing her. So we recognize this phenomenon of abuse bonding in America, and it's been widely influential in the recovery movements, as you probably know. But what I do, and not in his image, is I take this idea of abuse bonding, which I call the victim-perpetrator bond, and I apply it to history. And it goes a long way to explaining why this sick, insidious system could have prevailed. And so the only way for us to heal from this historical cycle of abuse bonding is to go back to the original wisdom of our bodies in connection with her. And the connection with her is rapture. I'll tell you, you want to know if you're connected with the goddess, do you feel rapture? Then you are. Do you not feel rapture? Then you're probably not. The connection to her is a current of rapture right through you, right through your pelvis, and from the earth. And they broke that connection. And can you imagine what an insane consequences there were of that?
We have about 25 minutes left, and I'm going to go ahead and, you know, for listeners who usually are accustomed to hearing the What's the Buzz segment, I think I'm just going to go ahead and skip that tonight because I'm enjoying our guests too much. So if you want to hear some of those topics we were going to talk about in What's the Buzz tonight, you'll catch them next week, listeners. I hope you don't mind. I'm sure you're enjoying John Lash as much as I am. Well, John, let me just ask you a couple other questions because I can imagine there are probably listeners out there who are thinking, okay, what if I don't relate to the Hindu goddesses? What if, say, I relate to the Celtic goddesses or the Egyptian goddesses? Can I still make this work? And I guess another question is Gaia Sophia. Is she all? Would you say she is all goddesses? You know, wrapped up into one. Could you describe her that way, or we can't go down that road?
Oh, we can certainly go down that road, and those are questions that come up and really essential questions to answer in order to lay the groundwork of Planetary Tantra. I've addressed many of those questions on the site in the Planetary Tantra section, so let me see if I give you a quick resume. In the first place, if you look at the Shakti cluster, it has these 18 nodes, and they are actually, I call it a console. It's like a console of 18 frequencies. So what I discovered is that the awareness of the goddess, the resurgence of her power and of her attention and intention toward us is absolutely vivid and real, and that it is a complex phenomena that has 18 modes to it, and you can learn and participate with those modes depending on your inclination. Now, I put down the caveat when I first described the Shakti cluster. I said, look, here, I'm using the names of 10 Hindu goddesses, the Mahavidyas that are in emanations of Kali, and I'm using 6 names of Buddhist Dakinis, Tantric Buddhist Dakinis. Kurukula is one of them. Vishwamata is another one. Vajrayogini is another one. And I'm using 2 other secret Dakini names, but these names are only introductory. They're like icons. You know, you can have an icon on your desktop, and you click it, and you get to a document. And you can change the icon and still get to the same document, you know? But these are the icons. I said I'm presenting it in the form of these icons first because that's received material from deep resources of goddess religion in India and Tibet. Deep resources. They're the purest resources that I know of. You know, the so-called Sri Vidya cult of Dravidian goddess worship has been one of my sources. And the other source has been Tantric Buddhism in the Nyingma sect. Now, I don't belong to either of these organizations, but I'm taking that material just to get us started, okay? Then I made the additional qualification, yes. Absolutely, you can go comparative with it. You can do it through Egyptian goddesses. You can do it through Celtic goddesses, for sure, for sure. Ceridwen. You can do it through Sekhmet. I'll give you an example. One of the Dakinis, now one of the Mahavidyas is called Bhairava, which means the terrible one. And she is like a lion-headed goddess, or Bhairavi, excuse me, feminine Sanskrit names end in I, so it's Bhairavi. And she is a lion-headed, ferocious Mahavidya. Well, what does a lion-headed, ferocious entity suggest to you?
Well, definitely Sekhmet.
Sekhmet. So if you want to see her as Sekhmet, the Egyptian, instead of as Bhairavi, the Hindu, you can do that. These names that we have received from them are just like projections of her imagination into our syntax, projections of her imagination into the psyche of the human being. And she has created these nodal identities, but they're completely mutable. And the more you get involved with a particular entity, for instance, if you were to practice with a Shakti cluster with Kurukula, which is one of the powerful dakinis in the central pentagram, it's a circle of 10 divinities with a central pentagram, and then a Vivi, or Gaia herself, in the center of that pentagram. And if you were to practice with Kurukula, you would find that the Tibetan images of Kurukula are just a gateway into this frequency. You see what I mean? And the fantastic thing is,
So each of the goddesses are all the ones that you're using the Hindu. So they're really energies or aspects. So if you can just make a correlation, parallel to another tradition, as long as the energy or the aspect, that they're parallel, that they're equal.
And as long as the energy has consistent features, because one of the fantastic things that I'm learning, and some people are practicing with me, is that when you learn these frequencies and their goddesses, they're all recognizable as they were to ancient people, indigenous peoples, by their particular properties and their capacities and their gifts. And it's so exciting that you can get to learn them individually. They're kind of like specialists, you know? Each one of them is kind of like a specialist, like Kurukula is a specialist in witchcraft, in the arts of enchantment, in sexual magic, you know. If you want to put a sexual spell on someone, then you go to Kurukula and discuss it with her, you know. And there is a lot of spell making and divination inside this Shakti cluster. In fact, it's going to be a horrific nightmare for the Christians of the land if this starts to be practiced by people, because it's going to be a return to the magic and the play that we were born for. You know, and there is a lot of mischief in there. There's some mischief in there too.
Well, that's definitely appealing. Anything to make the Christians' hair stand on end, for all the suffering they've caused in the world. But if someone's a Wiccan, for instance, can they sort of use the basis of what they've learned in Wicca, spell work and things like that, to practice this Shakti cluster? That you're saying to use this to reach Gaia Sophia?
Absolutely. You know, Wicca and planetary tantra is a marriage made in heaven. It really is.
Okay.
When Wiccans get to planetary tantra, they will not only be able to have their whole Wiccan practice, which is absolutely wonderful, and I love and adore all those Wiccans, you know, but they will also be able to focus it into the intimate connection of Sophia, into the intimacy of the planetary connection, and that is a new opportunity. It's another thing that can't really perhaps justify or explain in this conversation, but I strongly believe that this opportunity for this deep interactive connection with Gaia is uniquely emerging for our species at this time. And I think you could understand maybe hearing that claim, that would maybe naturally be the case, wouldn't it? Because of the serious crossroads that we find ourselves at, you know? We can't go on in the insanity that we have been plunged in. And there is no way but her way. And so this is the entrance into her way.
Well, I guess I just wonder and worry that, you know, people like you and I who have an idea. Well, I mean, you know, this is your practice, and, you know, some of us who are maybe just learning about this or have known about Goddess for a while, you know, I think we're maybe, ahead of the curve, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But still, how do you bring the rest along? You know, how do you bring the Christians along? How do you bring the people who don't even know there's a feminine face of God, for heaven's sake? Or do we not worry about that? You know, are they just going to be on at the caboose on the end of the train? I mean, I don't know.
It's not our job, Kate. I don't believe it's our job, Karen. I'll tell you something that I have learned. I have learned something from every one of these 18 Dakinis, 17 of them, and then one of them is Gaia herself, her own voice. She's the central figure in the Shakti cluster. She's the central node. So I've learned something from every one of these in the last 2 years. And some of my most shocking instruction has come from Kali, who happens to be my personal guardian. It's another thing I should mention that happens in the practice of planetary tantra. And it can happen spontaneously, or you can be introduced by someone who's in the practice. You find out who your guardian is specifically. That is to say, there is one emanation, one facet of the resurgent divine feminine that connects to you most closely, that connects to the whole pattern of your life that has been with you all your life. I first met my guardian in a lucid dream when I was 3.5 years old. Kali has been with me since I was 3.5 years old. And this is true of all of us who embrace and love the goddess, that we are given a specific Dakini or Devata guardian. So Kali's my guardian, and this is what she said to me. You can be, you humans can be part of my supernatural magic, or you can be rubble. This is what Kali said.
So Kali-like.
And she says, look at the cremation ground. Look at the cremation ground where I dance. What do you think that is? Do you think that that's a metaphor? This is no metaphor. She says, this is the most vivid visualization, unfortunately, of where some human beings are going to take themselves. And so if you don't want to go there, then play at Kali's game. Kali is so fantastic. I could tell you how much I love this creature, this entity. What she has taught me, she has saved my life so many times. What she has led me to.
Well, no, I think I know what you're talking about, because I feel very similar to it. Originally, I thought it was Isis, but I think more so it's always been Sekhmet.
It's a Sekhmet and Kali thing, Karen, and you have to be very, very delicate with it. And I would put it this way, because I don't want to scare anybody away here. What I've learned, what I continue to learn from Kali is, we let the divine powers make the selection of who comes into their magic. You don't make it. You let them make it. And you dedicate yourself to the goddess with the ruthlessness of a warrior. And the warrior does not take a hostile or harming view toward anyone, but neither does the warrior side with those who cannot enter the magic. Do you understand that? It's a really high teaching that I am learning to live with.
So in other words, you're saying you don't have to be aggressive toward the let's just say, you know, we'll use Christians as a group, or political parties who seem to be, you know, running the country into the ditch. You just make sure you side with people who are in alignment with, you know, with your thinking, with your values, and then things sort of take care of themselves. Is that what you're saying?
And they do. You know, I had a friend come here, a great friend of mine who's learning a lot about this tantra. He's a Lithuanian fellow that I met here in Spain. And he came to see me in 2008 when I was really in the height of my Dakini madness. I mean, I had just discovered the Shakti cluster, and I was like, I was in mania for 8 solid months, 24 hours a day. You know, divine delirium, divine madness. I was so out of it. It was unbelievably joyful. And so he came to me, and he hadn't seen me. He knew me before this, and he said, wow, John, you know, this is really wild. I mean, you're like telling me that you're discovering this connection with 18 frequencies of the goddess, you know, how can you handle it? And I said, I don't. It handles me. I live to handle me. Surrender is a tremendous part of the warrior's path. You know, to a warrior of Gaia, Kali, surrender is a tremendous act of courage and commitment. It's not an act of submission. You surrender. They handle it for you.
I'm laughing because not that long ago I wrote an article about the liberation of surrender, and I didn't know anything about this. interesting, very interesting.
And also you attract others by magic, and also you attract them by beauty, and you attract them by the aura of pleasure that flows through your life like an aroma, you know, and it's sometimes, not always, I do try to restrain myself a little bit, it's very difficult. But sometimes when people ask me, you know, hey, John, how are you? I say, I'm delightful. And then I look at them, and I watch how they react.
And
if
they
it looks
want
like
some of that.
They, yeah, and if it looks like they want some delight, I say, well, come on over, you know. But if they, like, are put off by it, then I just move on, you know. I have to tell you that one of the most satisfying things about entering into this connection with the goddess through this Gnostic wisdom, through the Sophia story and planetary tantra, is that it is sudden and spectacular practice. Now, there is a legend about Kali Yuga that is attributed to the historical Buddha, and very little of this legend was ever written down because he gave the secret teaching to his innermost disciples, whereas he gave another teaching about Buddhism to the world at large. The general or mundane teaching about Buddhism that Gautama gave is well known to everyone. Desire, Trishna, which is craving or desire, is the cause of all pain. The solution of the pain is to overcome craving, you know. So his generic message to the world was liberation from desire, because desire creates craving, craving creates, you know, craving for pleasure creates that. But he taught his secret disciples actually the opposite. He said, well, this teaching is true. People today need to realize this because they're hung up in certain things. But in some time in the future, he didn't say 2,500 years from now, but that's when it was, at the end of Kali Yuga, absolutely the opposite will be true. The path of supreme liberation will be through pleasure. Liberation by pleasure and not from pleasure. And there is so much pleasure in this path, and it is so immediate and vivid that it attracts people to you. And that becomes the magnet of your life in this practice.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, John, I'm sorry to say we're starting to run really short on time, and
mm-hmm.
we probably have about 6 minutes left.
Okay.
You've covered a lot, and I realize we couldn't go into anything in depth, but I think you've been really incredibly thorough, you know, even so. But in these last, you know, 5 or 6 minutes, what important points would you want to make that maybe you haven't yet?
Yeah, I would just, I think, like to make 2 points about the entrance or the approach toward this practice of interactive magic with Gaia, as I'm calling it. As I've observed, that I think one of the greatest impediments to approaching this is that many of the New Age teachings, the visionary teachings about love and enlightenment, may be fine on their own terms, but they overlook 2 things, in my view. First of all, they don't emphasize enough this living and intimate deep connection with the earth. They don't talk about Gaia and the planet enough. Can't do anything on our own. We do it with her and through her, or we don't do it at all. This is my view. This is my conviction. The second thing is that they tend to build a philosophy of or a picture of the coming planetary shift in very glowing terms, as if it were an individual act of self-empowerment by which we're going to rise to a higher frequency, and then we're going to change the whole course. We're going to make a course correction for our species. And what I find that's missing in that is the very element that people need to approach the Gaia Sophia connection. You need egoless immersion in nature. It's not an ego trip. So much of the New Age visionary teachings, although they are well meant, to me look like ego trips, because the message is not about a message of what we can do with her. It's just about a message of what we can do. And when you change that syntax, what can we do with her? What does she think of us? How does she see us? When you participate and enjoy and love exploring those aspects every day, then you are heading into this path. And one other thing I'd like to say, if I could give a formula to your listeners that they would use to start this practice, a very simple statement. It uses the word telluric, T-E-L-L-U-R-I-C, which means of the earth, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Every morning when you get up, before you do anything else, in the first 2 minutes of your day, say this aloud. Divine Sophia, sacred Gaia, reveal to me at your pleasure the mind-born splendor of telluric Dakinis.
Hmm.
Just say that phrase aloud, as if you were talking to a person. Yeah. The mind-born splendor of telluric Dakinis. And just say it, see what happens.
Okay. I can't wait to try.
Just try it out. No harm in trying.
So
this
now just
been a huge pleasure talking to you.
Say again?
It's been a huge pleasure talking with you.
Oh, it has. And I've really enjoyed it too. So John, would a good starting point for all of what we've talked about tonight, as well as trying the Shakti cluster and the ritual magic and connecting with Gaia Sophia so that we find the organic light, is the first step your book, Not in His Image?
That is like gives you the background and the foundation, certainly. And the myth is repeated and elaborated at length in that book. So that is the sort of the handbook for learning her story. But for dipping into it and getting initial glimpses to taste it and see where you want to go, go to metahistory.org, click on the site guide, and go to the sections on Gaia Sophia and Magdalene, and they will lead you into that, toward that experience, toward that experiment.
Wow. Okay. And so that's metahistory.org for listeners out there. Well, John, thank you so much for staying up all night to talk to us. I have certainly enjoyed the talk. I think you've really brought some enlightenment to our listeners out there. I wish we had more time. I have a half a dozen questions, but maybe we can have you back some other time on the show.
Certainly. I'd be most happy to talk to you again.
Okay. Well, wonderful. Thank you so very much. I appreciate it. And so do you have a next project coming up soon?
I'm writing screenplays right now, actually, and, putting some of this mystical and shamanic material into these screenplays in a coded form, so that's pretty exciting.
Oh, it's interesting. I'm sort of doing the same thing, so
anyhow,
I'll have to email you.
Great, do that. You stay in touch with me, please.
All right, I sure will, and again, thank you so very much for all you've shared tonight. It's been a pleasure.
Sure enough. All the best to you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.